What does the way we treat sex offenders say about our society?
We have these draconian laws now that bunch everybody in together. Serial rapists alongside, you know, a high school boy who's over 18 with a high school girlfriend who's under 18 having sex to some poor old set drunk, you know, urinating in a parking lot. They're all put in the same bag socially in terms of their relation to the rest of the community. They're turned into marginalized lepers, basically, who we don't want to think about.
That's Russell Banks. His new novel, Lost Memory of Skin, is about a young sex offender who forces us to ask some tough questions about society's hypocrisy.
By stopping and looking at trees, if we just take nature, for example, it's a really a way to stop and connect. Because often if you just wander down a trail, if it's winter, you might really see nothing but a blur of browns and grays. In the summertime, you might just see greens. But in this way, you get to stop and look. And once you kind of have something to get into, then there's a whole world of other things that you're going to see.
And that's conservation biologist Michael Vocek. He's written a guide to identifying trees. It's called Bark. And in our final segment, we talk with novelist Valerie Martin. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Russell Banks has long been one of my favorite novelists, ever since I read his 1989 novel, Affliction. He tells the stories of working-class people with a deep affection and respect. Unsparing in painting the struggles of their lives, he shows the strengths they reach for in response. His latest novel, Lost Memory of Skin, continues this tradition. It tells the story of a young man known only as The Kid. Cast out of society as a convicted sex offender, he's homeless because he can't live anywhere within 2,500 feet of where children may congregate. Despite the stain of his crime, the kid garners the reader's sympathies. That's because he seems like basically a good guy. He cares deeply for his pet iguana, he's harder on himself than he needs to be, and he's searching for a way to become a better person despite the attempts of society to slap him down at every turn. And we sense that his punishment is way out of proportion to his crime. But Lost Memory of Skin is about more than one young sex offender. It holds a mirror up to society itself, showing the hypocrisy that leads it to ostracize a young man like the kid while pushing the pornographic currency of sex and violence in media and the culture. Russell Banks's main works include the novels Cloud Splitter, The Sweet Hereafter, and Affliction. He won the John Dos Passos Prize for Fiction in 1985 and was elected a Fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 1996. Well, Russell Banks, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
This was a terrific book. I've long been a fan of yours. This one, it's hard to say, you know, one book or the other is my favorite, maybe each time I read one I think this one is, but this is just a profoundly moving and wonderful book, Lost Memory of Skin. It's about a young man who's living a homeless life after having been convicted of being a sex offender. Before we get more into the story, though, or maybe this will get us into the story, tell us about the title, Lost Memory of Skin.
One of the central themes or contexts for the novel is that fuzzy gray zone that has come to exist between fantasy and reality, sexual fantasy and sexual reality in particular, and largely in the last decade and a half, maybe, or two decades, and largely due to the internet and to the proliferation of pornography and so forth, such that people have lost sight of that sharp line that previously seemed to exist between fantasy and reality. And so it's like a lost memory of skin, of the tactile reality, of the erotic, I guess you could say. So I think that's what I'm trying to point to with the title. And the kid, the central character in the novel, and also in his way, too, the professor, the secondary character, and then many of the people that surround them, and maybe many of my readers as well, have lost the memory, even, of what it's like to have actual physical contact with other human beings. So I'm trying to open that up as a context for what is essentially a story of a young man, you know, on a very serious quest.
A serious quest?
Yeah. I mean, he's looking for, ultimately, meaning in his life, like most of us, but he's doing it at a very particular stage of life. He's only 22 years old, and he's, in a way, not had much of a life up to now. So he's seeking out a way to put meaning into his life, slowly and bit by bit, against tremendous obstacles.
Yeah, those tremendous obstacles being that he has been convicted of being a sex offender.
Right.
You say you were just talking about how we've lost the tactile physical contact. This book is also very much about social isolation.
Yeah.
You know, we start out the book, he's living in a place under a causeway with other sex offenders because there's no other place for him to live.
Right. Yeah, that's actually based on an event you may be familiar with from the press a few years ago in Miami. It turned out there was a whole colony, in a way, of convicted sex offenders living under the Tuttle Causeway, which connects the mainland to Miami Beach in Miami. And it happened as a result, an unintended consequence of laws that were passed in Florida, and South Florida particularly, that prohibited sex offenders from living anywhere within 2,500 feet of any place where children gathered. Schoolyards, or you know, or child centers, or even playgrounds, or libraries, or anything like that, and so that meant, in a sense, that they couldn't, in a real sense, that they couldn't live anywhere in the city, and so the you know, parole officers and police and city officials started just dropping these guys off there and leaving them to their, you know, their own devices, and pretty soon they, you know, they had built an encampment and had become a community. And I was just sort of taken by that, and taken by the awful, dark irony of it, and then the unintended consequences of these laws now, which are proliferating all across the country, and little colonies like this are starting to pop up everywhere, and it has a lot to do with the kind of fear and even panic that we're going through as a culture, really, with regard to child abuse, sexual child abuse, and sex offending.
At the same time that pornography is proliferating.
Yeah, yeah, right. And at the same time we're using sex in every possible way to sell consumer goods. And it's almost a diabolical situation, and I don't think that, you know, we've looked at it awfully closely. I mean, I've sort of studied the literature, and there are a few figures out there who have made a serious investigation of it and are dealing with it, and I think some politicians are, but most people don't dare speak of it and don't dare speak of it in any critical way.
Well, yeah, I mean, the kid here, he's 22, his offense, such as it was, occurred when he was 17.
No, it actually occurred when he was 22. Had occurred recently. He's 23 at the opening.
Oh, okay.
And it occurred when he was 22, but with a girl who was 14.
That's right. So he was 22.
Right.
With a girl, although you say with a girl who was 14, he actually didn't actually do anything.
No, but he solicited her on the internet, and or maybe she solicited him. It's not quite clear.
Mm-hmm.
And he ended up trying to meet her, clearly, for a sexual encounter. And that's what he got turned in for.
Right. So this is a very complicated situation, and I don't know how much you want to reveal in
no, it's about as much, I think,
okay,
at this point, yeah.
All right.
In that regard, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Happy to talk about any number of aspects, but you don't want to give away the whole plot.
Absolutely. But it still, nonetheless, seems that he hardly would have passed for a sex offender in the past.
That's right.
What's really going on? I mean, he is a sex addict. addict.
Right. He's a pornography addict, yeah.
But is he a sex offender?
Yeah, that's the good question. And you know, we have these draconian laws now that bunch everybody in together, serial rapists alongside, you know, a high school boy who's over 18 with a high school girlfriend who's under 18 having sex to some poor old sad drunk, you know, urinating in a parking lot. They're all put in the same bag. Socially, in terms of their relation to the rest of the community, they're turned into marginalized lepers, basically, who we don't want to think about.
And he's especially vulnerable because he, yeah, in some ways, has been isolated.
Right.
Always. Talk right. A little bit about that.
Yeah, he's like an awful lot of kids who grow up, you know, barely literate, single parent who's too distracted, busy, or depressed or whatever, to provide anything like support or protection. So he's essentially raised himself, a latchkey kid, I guess we used to call them. But the numbers are enormous. So he's not, you know, unique in any way, and he's not even atypical in many ways. And he's a loser. He's a kid who walks into trouble, or trouble finds him, not because he has bad luck, but he's basically got no real survival skills in this complicated world.
Well, what also comes across, though, is how likable he is, how basically decent he is.
Well, I'm glad. I hope that comes across, because it's really hard to get engaged by a character with his particular sociological characteristics, unless he's got an attractive voice and an attractive wit and mind about him, and I think he does. I think he's intelligent. I think he's funny. He has an angle on things that's irreverent and humorous, and so I found him wonderfully engaging myself, or I wouldn't have been able to spend 3 years with him writing the book.
We're talking with Russell Banks, novelist Russell Banks, about his latest book, Lost Memory of Skin. He's also very caring, especially about his iguana.
Right, his animals. You know, it starts with his that's the first and perhaps the only creature he's ever loved, and is this about 30-inch long iguana who becomes very dear to him and intimate. It's his companion and his only companion.
Now, we won't talk more about Iggy the iguana, but as you say, his animals.
Well, he's on the cover, so that.
Okay. Yeah, okay. We can
he's
talk.
Very central.
He is.
Iggy the iguana, yes.
He is. Now, at a certain point, you say the police have dropped these men off who have no place to live because, you know, with overlapping circles of 2,500 feet, there are kids everywhere.
Right.
But then there's a raid, and their encampment is completely torn up by the police. Why did you put this in?
This, too, is based on real events as well, because it became sort of a scandal once the public got wind of it and politicians started railing against the encampment, and so, you know, just before election day, it got raided, and then they tried to move them around into the city, and there was no place, you know, it was not in my backyard kind of situation, and eventually they all drifted back.
Then you introduce another character, the other main character, who is fascinating in his own right, possibly not quite as likable.
Yeah.
The professor.
Right. Yes, the sociologist who's making a study of convicted sex offenders and the homeless convicted sex offenders and the social phenomenon of that. He's obsessed with it in his own way, and his relationship with the kid becomes very interesting, I think, and complicated because the kid is the subject for his study on the one hand, and on the other, he's engaging the professor. Personally, the professor likes him, finds him endearing in many ways. And so the two of them gradually create a bond between them, an unlikely bond in some ways, perhaps, but one that allows both the professor and the kid to tell their stories to each other.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with novelist Russell Banks about his latest book, Lost Memory of Skin. And the professor even though he's, you know, supposedly the most intelligent man in the whole area, and he's got this, honors up the wazoo, is also incredibly socially isolated. Talk about his social isolation. How is that both similar to and different from that of the kid?
Well, he's isolated partly because he's morbidly obese. He's a man who can't stop eating. He's devouring the world in a way, and so he's an enormous man, and that has isolated him from other people, both visually and physically, and in some of the same ways that the kid has been isolated, although the professor doesn't make that connection at all. I think probably the reader will make that connection. And then the professor has secrets and lies and compartments in his life that haven't communicated with each other for his entire life. And so, in a way, he's a man who's shut himself away from, or has been shut away from the larger world and from the from the community, from his wife and from his parents and from his children. He's a detached observer. It's quite different in that respect from the kids, who's not in the slightest detached from other people. He sees a lot that and feels a lot for other people in ways that the professor never can.
Yet you also have the professor, you put in his mouth some very interesting observations, and if I may quote from your book just a little bit here of one of them. Here he is talking to his, well, do you have the book there?
I don't, no,
oh,
not
okay.
In front of me.
Then I will. Here he is talking to his wife, Gloria, the professor is, and he's talking about sex offenders. He says, these men are human beings, not chimpanzees or gorillas. They belong to the same species as we do. And I'm going to skip a little bit. He says, if, as it appears, the proportion of the male population who commit these acts has increased exponentially in recent years, and it's not simply because of the criminalization of the behavior and the consequent increase in the reportage of these crimes, then there's something in the wider culture itself that has changed in recent years. These men are like the canary in the mine shaft, the first among us to respond to that change. I'm going to stop there before maybe I go on a little bit. Could you comment on that a bit?
Yeah, I think what the professor is reflecting on and pointing to is a shift that he says, or he believes, took place probably starting, I think he points back to the 1950s and 60s, when children became a huge segment and eventually the largest and self-replicating segment of the consumer economy. And we started sexualizing children because sex sells. And what he means by, I think, the canaries in the mine is that the marginalized, the people who are sexually confused or who are sexually shaky in various ways, are the ones who respond most radically, perhaps, to that kind of shift in the culture. And I think he speaks elsewhere, too, about the fact that, in the past, children have always been protected from the material world, in a way, from consumerism and so forth. But once you bring into the home, the salesman in the form of the television, and once that becomes the babysitter, then you've essentially abandoned the children. I mean, part of that is shown in the life of the kid. The kid is himself been abandoned, but in a way that has happened to millions of kids over the last three or four generations. So I think the professor's kind of looking at it in an anthropological way, looking at our culture in an anthropological way.
Mm-hmm. And pedophiles are supposed to be driven by their own sense of inadequacy with respect to other adults. And is that why you have the professor devise a cure? His idea of the cure is by changing the pedophile's personal perception of power.
Right. He thinks it's all about power. And I'm not saying I share all the professor's perspectives or theories. He is, after all, a sociologist, and I'm just a storyteller. But But he does have this theory that it's not about sex, it's about power. And we've heard that before over the last couple of generations. I mean, that's not an uncommon perspective, especially with regard to rape or sexual offenders. And so he thinks, well, if I can just find a way to give these people some sense of control and power in their lives, then that would provide them with the beginnings of a cure. And so he sets about. He's got this sort of laboratory, in a way, within this colony of men to work with. So he sets about trying to help them organize control over their lives and give them power over this little community, in a sense. Hoping that eventually it will, as he thinks, cure them.
What do you think of that?
What do I think of the professor's theory? I think his theory is fine. I don't think the laboratory quite. I don't think he's working with laboratory conditions particularly. He's working with a bunch of odd and eccentric and greatly varied human beings, it's pretty difficult to apply his experiment to them. And he ultimately does fail in his experiment. But I thought it was worth giving it a shot anyhow and seeing how far he could go with it.
I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and I'm talking with novelist Russell Banks about his acclaimed new novel, Lost Memory of Skin. He does affect, or this experiment, it seemed to me, does boost the transformation, or brings the protagonist, the kid, closer to the realization of his quest.
That's right, it does. And it gives him an ability, in a way, to see himself in a larger context, as an actor, as a person who has a very small but a very real force in the world. And in fact, when he sets out and takes control over his own life and moves out of from underneath the causeway, and ends up like Huck Finn on a raft out in the great swamp. He couldn't have conceivably done that at the beginning of the novel, at the beginning of the story. It's really, I think, in that sense, with regard to the kid, the professor's theory begins to take hold. Can only go so far because of the realities of the kid's situation and the realities of the kid's life, but at least the kid is becoming aware of himself and of himself in a larger context than his immediate surroundings.
And by reality, we're saying, you know, he's wearing an ankle bracelet, right. He has to recharge it every 72 hours or
That's
something
right.
like that. But, I wanted to ask you, and we're speaking with novelist Russell Banks about his latest book, Lost Memory of Skin. The kid struggles with guilt, responsibility, accountability. I'd have to say, I almost felt, I wanted to tell him, like I think some of the characters in the book do tell him, it's not your fault. But he takes very seriously the sense of taking accountability for what he has done. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that too. I mean, his crime just doesn't seem that great, and yet he seems to use it as a springboard for a deeper understanding of himself.
Yeah, the punishment doesn't fit the crime, it's true. But I think whenever that happens, no matter that the punishment doesn't fit the crime, we do feel as though, on some level, it must, or we wouldn't have been punished this way. And I think the kid is responding to that. He knows that he begins, as an outsider, as someone who is not connected, as a schoolboy, to any family members. He's isolated to begin with, and when society punishes him, it seems on some level probably appropriate and necessary, and so he feels guilty. And even though we know, we standing away here in the distance, we can say, well, yeah, come on, that punishment doesn't fit that crime, but it's legal nonetheless, and so he has to roll with it. But I think as a character, he's a kind of self-examining, self-questioning, little wise guy, and his manner seems to be that social manner is that of a kind of defensive and deflective wise guy. But we know because we were able to enter into his mind and his emotions, thanks to the miraculous powers of fiction, we know that he's feeling guilty and somehow he is screwed up and it's his fault and his life is a mess because he made it a mess and so on, because that's what everyone's telling him.
Yeah,
from the psychiatrist that he's dealing with when he's in prison, to the guys that are surrounding him, to the community as a whole.
Right.
They're all telling him the same thing. You screwed up your life.
Yeah, and so much of that is the way we do treat people in the society.
Right.
Could you, were there any great challenges? And you've written now quite a few novels. I wonder if there was anything special about this book that might have been a challenge for you in the writing of it.
Well, I think the first thing was just kind of staring down and dealing with in a unabashed way the whole question and the whole issue of sex offenders in our society, and not in any sense defending, but also not in any way judging or condemning it. I mean, I think that a novelist has to do that. You can't sentimentalize and you can't judge. You can't idealize or judge, and if you're going to see it clearly. And then this is a subject that, it has a lot of taboo associated with it. It's one that we only tend to think of in terms of black or white, and we don't see... We don't humanize the people who commit these, crimes, because they are crimes, and see the complexity of it, and the ambiguity of so many of the aspects of it. We just wipe them aside, and that was, I think, for me the biggest task, because I'm a member of the larger community too, and I carry with me most of the same, prejudices and biases and inclinations that most everybody else does. So I had to really push that aside and deal with these characters, but in particular with the kid and the men who surround him down there under the causeway, with affection and with respect.
And with deep compassion.
And with, I hope, with compassion, yes.
Yeah. Well, Russell Banks, it is just a wonderful novel.
Thank you so much.
Lost Memory of Skin, thanks so much for talking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for talking with me.
Novelist Russell Banks. You can read an excerpt from Lost Memory of Skin at writersvoice.net. You can read an excerpt from Lost Memory of Skin at writersvoice.net. Next up, Michael Wojcik tells us how to identify trees after their leaves have fallen off. His book is Bark. You're listening to Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Later in the show, we'll talk with novelist Valerie Martin. But first, let's talk about trees. I rarely go into the woods in summer anymore. Too many ticks. Instead, I go in fall and winter, when most of the trees have lost the leaves I use to identify them. But with Michael Wojcik's new book, Bark in Hand, I'm all set for cold weather forays into the forest. Wojcik is a conservation biologist who's developed a handy scheme for identifying trees by their bark. It's not as straightforward as you may think, because bark, like our skin, changes over time. Michael Wojcik, I loved knowing that there was a book like this, Bark, A Field Guide to Trees of the Northeast, because I have an awful lot of trouble identifying trees. I don't know anything or didn't know anything about their bark before I read this book. Tell us, why is bark actually the best way to identify trees?
One of the main reasons is that it's always visible and always available to look at. And I can kind of relate a story, and the way this whole project started. It was about 10 years ago, and I was racing through the woods one October afternoon trying to complete an inventory of the trees growing in a conservation area over in Northampton. And the last leaves of the season were raining down upon me, and it was that last storm of the season in October where I knew that within a day or so there would be nothing but bare branches left. And leaves were the only way I could identify trees at the time. And even those are quite high up on the branches. And winter tree identification guides, they refer to twigs and buds and those characteristics, which are definitely not visible on forest trees. So that's the main reason, is that it's always there.
You know, one thing that surprised me in reading this book is that bark actually changes its appearance throughout the life cycle of the tree. Is this why sometimes I can see a tree that seems to have two or three different kinds of bark in it?
On one tree?
Yeah.
Well, I can tell a little bit about the progress that happens with most trees, and that will help to explain it. All trees start out with smooth bark as a sapling, and if you think of probably the one that you can identify most is an American beech tree, the one where people carve initials in. And those trees stay smooth as the tree grows and as it matures. But most trees, actually, the bark, well, there's a premise behind this. The wood is beneath the bark, and the layer is, of course, encasing the outside of the bark around the circumference of the tree. And in many trees, the wood actually grows at a faster rate than the bark can actually grow. So at some point, this initial smooth layer begins to break apart. And it has to do with the structure of each species, how that happens and what it actually looks like. But if you think of a red oak, a northern red oak, for example, it starts out with this smooth bark, and eventually these vertical cracks start to develop as that wood starts to expand, and this initial layer of bark can't expand at the same rate. And I sometimes like to use the analogy of it split its pants in a way.
And one thing that struck me in reading this book also is that it almost seems as if bark is analogous to skin. You know, it gets more wrinkled over time.
It does in many species, and in others, like American beech, it doesn't. Getting back to that northern red oak, eventually new layers have to form beneath this outer layer, because you're right, it is kind of like skin in that it's a protective layer.
Yeah, talk a little bit more about that. How does bark act as a protection for the tree?
Well, there are two main layers to bark, and the inner bark and the outer bark. And the inner bark is the live tissue of the bark, and its main function is actually to transport the products of photosynthesis throughout the tree. And then the layer outside of that is actually composed mostly of dead cells, and it's actually to keep the inner tissues, the live tissues, from drying out, and also keep any type of intruding insects or pathogens from invading into the living tissues of the tree. So in that way, it certainly functions like skin.
You have some very interesting pictures in the book, Bark, Michael Wojcik, of kind of burls and calluses and growths on trees. I think we see these pretty commonly. I know I never knew what caused them. Talk about those things. Are they part of the protective defenses of the tree?
Yes, they certainly are. Any tree is going to have penetrations through its protective outer bark at any given time. It's kind of like our skin. Just because we get a cut doesn't mean we're going to die or we're going to lose a limb. So it's normally a matter of a multitude of things kind of stacking up that a tree can't handle, where it really leads to damage, serious damage or death of the tree. So one of the things I think you're talking about might be cankers, which are fungal infections that actually gain access through the outer bark for any number of reasons. It could be the claw marks of a bear that climbed the tree. It could be a woodpecker or someone who penetrated through the outer bark, a limb that happened to blow down and fall off. But these fungi actually start to penetrate through to the living tissues of the tree, and then what the tree actually does is it encapsulates that infection, and in a way, anything inside that encapsulation is dead tissue now, mm-hmm. because it's cut off from the living processes of the tree. So these cankers, that may be the end of it, in an annual canker where the tree has done its job and that's it, or this fungal infection is actually stronger and waits for the tree to go into dormancy, or in some other method actually goes beneath this encapsulation into the wood and starts to continually infect the tree. Mm. In fact, there's one canker in red maples called target canker, which actually shows up as a series of somewhat concentric rings over time, as it's kind of this back and forth battle that no one really wins, where the tree does its job encapsulating and then the fungus comes back and reinfects and then it does more encapsulations over time.
Hmm. Now, you worked very hard to devise a system of identification. I mean, is this really the first book to examine tree identification from the point of view of its bark?
I'm certainly not the first. I think I've taken a little different tact in writing a key of this nature, a dichotomous key with a series of yes-no questions that lead the user through the key.
So talk about that key.
The key is really based upon bark structure. So what I did is I went back to look at how bark forms and some of the things we've just been talking about to try to come up with some language to describe.
So take that red oak. How do you describe that according to the key in this book, bark?
The species, and many species actually show up more than once in the key because of those multiple stages. One of the things that happens with northern red oak, for example, is that these cracks develop that I mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. and then they deepen over time and multi-layers of bark form. Mm-hmm. But the outer surface of these ridges actually stay smooth. That's the original bark that's still intact. And they actually create almost like columns as you look up the tree, where it looks columned, or sometimes it can even look as if there are parallel ski tracks running up the trunk. And that's only one stage. And then eventually all those outer layers begin to break up and it becomes very rough and deeply furrowed with thick ridges.
So if there are different stages, how are you going to know, how does one use the key to identify that this is this tree going through a certain stage?
It starts out with a primary key that uses a series of bark types that I developed. So the primary key leads you to one of seven secondary keys, and goes through a series of a multitude of different type of characteristics. It might be that the surface of the bark is checkered, or it might be that it's peeling, or it might be that it has thin black horizontal lines like a paper birch, which are called lenticels. So I used anything and everything that I could find to differentiate one species from another, but one of the keys in making the key usable was the fact that it's separated into seven short keys. Mm-hmm. Because to have one giant key with 100 stages, I don't think lots of people would be interested in going through that.
So why don't we read an example from the book? Would you like to pick an example from the book to show us? Actually, it seems to be almost in the form of a tree itself. These are like decision trees.
So we can open up to the inside front cover and get right to the primary bark key. And this is going to take us sequentially through the different bark types. So the first one is peeling horizontally in curly strips. So let's go there. So it says go to key one, which is on page 38. And here's key one, which happens to be the shortest key. So stage one, lenticels are clearly visible, which are those dark horizontal lines. They can be of different shapes, diamond-shaped or round. Yes, go to stage two. No, then this would be a young river birch. Now, if the answer was yes, and we go to stage two, the bark is bronze to yellowish. If the answer to that question is yes, we have a mature yellow birch. If the answer is no, bark is not bronze to yellow, go to stage three. Peeling layer is white, then we're looking at a mature paper birch. And if the peeling layer is not white, then we could be looking at a mature pin cherry.
That's great. So it's really very simple. One can take this book along and just kind of, you start with one, correct? And then that will just lead you through a decision tree to all the other ones.
That's the concept. And what I hope I've accomplished and the feedback I've gotten from having folks test the key out is to really make this accessible. My goal was not to write a book only for scientists, although I hope that they find it scientifically rigorous enough to use. But I really want this to be accessible to anyone.
And you talk in this book, Michael Vocek, you talk in BARC about the art of seeing. How did you develop this art in your own journey of writing this book?
That was the biggest process when I really stopped to look at it now that it's all done, is learning the art of seeing. And perhaps the biggest and most rewarding thing that I can give to other people, because by stopping and looking at trees, if we just take nature, for example, it's a really a way to stop and connect. Because often if you just wander down a trail, if it's winter, you might really see nothing but a blur of browns and grays. In the summertime, you might just see greens. But in this way, you get to stop and look. And once you kind of have something to get into and stop, then there's a whole world of other things that you're going to see.
Well, the book is BARC, A Field Guide to Trees of the Northeast. And we've been speaking with the author, Michael Vocek. Thanks so much for coming into Writer's Voice.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Michael Vocek writes about, conducts workshops on, illustrates and photographs the identifying characteristics and ecology of trees.
Today I am a small blue thing, like a marble or an eye, with my knees against my mouth. I am perfectly round. I am watching you. I am cold against your skin. You are perfectly reflected. I am lost inside your pocket. I am lost against your fingers. I am falling down the stairs. I am skipping on the sidewalk. I am thrown against the sky. I am raining down in pieces. I am scattering like light. Scattering like light. Scattering like light. Today I am a small blue thing, made of china, made of glass. I am cool and smooth and curious. I never blink. I am turning in your hand, turning in your hand. I am cold against your skin. You are perfectly reflected. I am lost inside your pocket. I am lost against your fingers. I am falling down the stairs. I am skipping on the sidewalk. I am thrown against the sky. I am raining down in pieces. I am scattering like light. Scattering.
Every year at Mount Holyoke College, writers get together to talk about writing and publishing at the annual Right Angles Conference. This year, novelist Valerie Martin will be giving the keynote speech. Last month, I caught up with her in her office at the college to ask her about her approach to the craft of writing. Valerie Martin's novels tend to have very strong female protagonists. Like the main characters in her 2007 novel Trespass, which we spoke to her about in early 2008. I started out our interview by referencing that book. And that was about a kind of confrontation between a privileged upper middle class mother and her son's girlfriend, who is a Balkan refugee, quite on the other end of the social spectrum, and yet somebody who's kind of taking a place. And then there was Mary Riley, which was told from the voice of Dr. Jekyll's maid. And another novel, Property, was told from the voice of a slave-owning woman in a time when there are rumors of rebellion. These seem very much themes where women of privilege and women who are not privileged are in some way confronting each other.
Yeah, that's interesting. I guess I hadn't thought about it that way, but it certainly is true that in each of those cases, there is a woman who has power and one who doesn't. And Mary Riley, of course, Mary Riley has no power, and her boss has two personalities, so that one less so, but certainly in Property and Trespass. I like the idea of doubles, and doubles, almost all my books have one kind or another of a doubling going on, that one character in some ways is the shadow or the dark side. Or in the last book about actors, it's the actor Edward Day has a double who even looks like him and who saves his life and tries to steal his girl and get his parts, because they're both actors, they look alike. So that's part of why you see these two women characters, one with power and one without, confronting one another. It is that thematic motif that I like. But all the writing that I've done, I think, has had to do with situations where one person has power over another person, or where there's something at stake, because those stories interest me. Those are the stories I like to, kind of stories I like to read.
Mm-hmm. And they are very much stories that speak to a women's position.
Yes, well, women's position. Mm-hmm. It both never changes, but in fact, in some ways, has changed. One thing that I have consciously done, especially in a couple of collections of short stories, is to look at stories written by men and then rewrite them as a woman who is attracted to what's going on in that story. Sort of put a woman in it is how I describe it. I take a story that I like and put a woman in it, which is essentially what Mary Riley was. I'd always loved Jekyll and Hyde. It's such a beautiful little novel. It's a joy to teach. It's very modern, very way ahead of its time. People just don't realize what a jewel it is. And I just was reading it for the umpteenth time and noticing this maid who was in it, and I thought, there's a woman in it, and decided that there might be a story there, that I would put a woman in it. So that's what I've done. I've done that in a lot of short stories, actually.
What do you mean that it's modern? What makes a modern novel?
Well, I think it's formally innovative. The story is told from three different points of view. The first part of it is, I'm trying to remember, it's been a long time since I've read it now, but the first part of it is just a conversation that goes on between two lawyers passing a wall, and they're talking about the doctor who lives on the other side. And then the last part of it is Jekyll's own confessions, which are not really trustworthy. So it plays with the whole idea of narration, of who to trust, who to believe, of a document, of documentation, and it also has a lot to say about class. But I think formally, it's for its time, I think it's rather experimental. Mm-hmm. And so that makes me describe it as a very modern little novel.
So here you're fascinated by the theme of power. Are there other themes that illuminate your work?
Well, the last few years I've been writing about artists a lot. I wrote a collection of stories called The Unfinished Novel and Other Stories, which is all about artists, writers, painters, actors, dancers. It was in that collection that I began to get interested in the whole notion of an actor as a character I would like to investigate. And so then I later wrote a whole novel about an actor. And I think it's an interesting and sort of rich soil to work in, because artists are so, well, they're doubled. You know, they have these two lives, of their ordinary life and the life that they live in their work. So that appeals to me. And there's just so much angst and anger and jealousy and drama in the lives of artists, although it may all take place in a very small realm that most people wouldn't want to enter, especially if they have good sense, that it's rich. It's good stuff to write about. I've been enjoying that.
It's funny that you say that because I recently interviewed Gail Levin, who wrote the biography of Lee Krasner. And I actually know something about that society because Jackson Pollock's friend Harold and promoter Harold Rosenberg was a good friend of my parents, and and they, you know, they lived in the Hamptons, and I had no idea of the scandals and the jealousies and the, you know, the rages that went on between all of these people.
Yeah, it's really great to find out what really goes on in the lives of artists. Somebody like Pollock, where you look at the paintings, I mean, you got to look at the paintings and think there's some chaos here. So maybe in a way it's not such a surprise that his life was like that. But I think all artists are, you know, because the goal is so noble and high and the actual business of it is so mean and sometimes narrow that it really is hard on the psyche.
And it makes for great fiction.
And it makes for good fiction. I mean, the stories, if you spend any time talking to almost any artist, the stories that you hear, you think, let me just go and write that down, just what they're up to.
Valerie Martin has been teaching writing to college students for 20 years. She teaches now at Mount Holyoke College. I asked her how much writing good fiction depends on having a gift or depends on the kind of instruction you can get. I tried my hand at fiction. I'm a nonfiction writer. I feel very comfortable with nonfiction, even creative nonfiction, possibly the most comfortable of all the genres. Fiction, I just couldn't imagine how one can inhabit totally different characters, and I realized I have no gift that way. So is that something somebody like me could actually learn, or really is that an innate gift?
Well, I think what you said, I couldn't imagine, is all you need to know. If the notion of entering a character, not yourself, is unimaginable, then I would say it's going to be pretty difficult to ever do it. And it really is a sort of turn of the imagination. I mean, when I read a story, I'm attracted to the characterization, and I'm interested in how the writer has caused me to respond to the character the way I do. So I really respond to a writer's skill as a writer, but most readers of fiction respond to the characters as if they were real. And this is sometimes very disturbing. I have an email in my box right now in which someone who read Trespass writes to me and says, how could you kill this character? She was the only intelligent, insightful, caring, good person in the book, and you killed her. Another person wrote about the same character being killed. I was chastised. And she said, I just wasted my whole afternoon reading your book. How could you kill Chloe? She's the most interesting. And those useless men. So this is a real gut response to the work. I mean, when I read a book in which a character is surprisingly murdered or dies, suddenly my sense is, so that's what he decided to do with that character. I never identify with characters in this way that some readers do. So it makes me think that to be able to do it, you have to have both ability to identify and imagine, as well as this distance, which is always conscious of creating a character. Because I'm trying to create a believable character, and to me that is a complex person. It's never a simple person. So I'm not expecting readers to react the way they sometimes do. But I assume that they react the way they do because I succeeded.
How do you create a believable character?
Well, I think characters are complex. I guess the difference would be, how do you create a cliched character? Everything is on the surface. Everything is expected. Or if you read a detective story, you know, the detective is very much a detective. Sometimes he'll have a little hobby or something, but he's basically a kind of stock character. So I guess when I think of what you're calling, and I'm calling, a believable character, a complicated character, it is somebody who is beyond the stock character and beyond the cliche. How do you do that? Well, you've got what they say, what they do, and what they think, and that's all you've got. So I just try to go with that and stay with it and give them the courtesy of thinking that their responses are not going to be always what one would expect.
So there's an element of surprise that's needed for the reader.
It is for me. I mean, I love it when a character surprises me when I'm reading. I think, oh, she did that. I think, oh, don't do that. I really love when you're reading a novel and a character's doing something, you think, don't do it. When I was writing Mary Riley, I sometimes got her from the desk saying, you know, don't you see? Can't you see what's going on? Yeah, it's that. It's that element of surprise that comes from, and to me is the most pleasurable part about writing, of having, you know, realizing that in some ways you know more about a character than you thought you did.
Well, that makes some sense to me. And I wonder if in some ways some of that can be taught, because I think maybe the failure of the imagination might partly come from feeling that you don't have the right to imagine what another character might have thought.
Yeah, I like that. That is a notion these days, especially since I write historical fiction sometimes. And if there's a real character in the story and I imagine myself into his head, I'm doing that right now with Arthur Conan Doyle, there are readers who think, how do you have the nerve to imagine yourself into someone's head? But, I mean, my view is, what is your imagination for? Are you supposed to always sit locked in this box that's your own head and never leave and have everyone else in the world be a mystery to you? I mean, it's true that that sort of is our situation vis-a-vis other people, but a piece of fiction is a place where you can actually have this play, this playful freedom of imagining yourself into a head not your own. And I think I have a perfect right to do it. I'm not hurting anyone.
So tell us what you're working on, if you can. Some people don't like to.
It is historical fiction, and it concerns a ship, the Mary Celeste, which was found in 1872 off the coast of the Azores, and it was in perfect condition, but there was no one on it. The crew had disappeared. It's a very famous naval mystery, and that's sort of at the center of the book I'm working on, but it in some ways is not the only thing the book is about, but that's how I got started.
That's great. Now you're going to be giving the keynote speech at Right Angles Conference 2011?
That's right. I didn't realize it was going to be called a keynote speech. It's not really going to be much of a speech, but I'm just going to talk about writing historical fiction. I taught a course here a year ago in writing historical fiction, and I just had a ball. The students were really good and excited. Many of them were history majors. And I'm sort of on a crusade now. I think that it's a good thing for writing students to try to go into the past and find a story that they want to tell and do a little research. It's very good to do research and to learn how to do research. So I'm just going to talk about writing historical fiction and what I do and what one does and what some of the questions about historical fiction are. And especially that question that you raised of imagining oneself into the head of someone who actually did live. Do we have some obligations to that person? Some people say we do.
Novelist Valerie Martin. She'll be giving the keynote speech at the 2011 Right Angles Conference on Saturday, October 22nd at Mount Holyoke College's Willits Hallowell Conference Center in South Hadley. Martin will talk about writing historical fiction. Go to writersvoice.net to hear our extended interview where Martin talks more about writing historical fiction and also about her own literary influences. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.